From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. The incredibly complex global food production systems we've come to rely upon rely in part on pollinators. They're animals that help plants reproduce by moving pollen from one flower to another, allowing plants to produce fruit, seeds, and new plants. Most people think of bees when they hear the word pollinator, and there are more than 300 different kinds of bees just here in Florida, so we're not just talking about domesticated honeybees, but butterflies and moths, beetles, flies, bats, and even some kinds of birds all do their part pollinating the plants around us. About 75% of the world's flowering plants and about 30% of crops rely on pollinators. Things like habitat loss, pesticide use, climate change, and invasive species are all threats to pollinator populations, which are truly essential for both ecological balance and food security. Later this week, on Friday, August 21st, and Saturday, the 22nd, and everyone can do their part as citizen scientists to help researchers keep tabs on the health of pollinator populations by participating in the Great Southeast Pollinator Census. To participate during those 2 days, you simply pick one or more plants in your yard that attract pollinators and watch them closely for 15 minutes and then count each time an insect lands on the plant and then upload that information into a database. To learn about the census and how to participate and about pollinators and how important it is to support them, I spoke with three people from local UF IFAS Extension offices. This conversation originally aired last August before that census, but since it contained so much good information, we're not reinventing the wheel and listening back to it today. Cheryl Vanderheiden is a residential horticulture extension agent with University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences, or IFAS's Lee County Extension Office. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Jen Hagen is a family and consumer sciences agent, also with IFAS's Lee County Extension Office. Jen, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And Jonah Vasquez is an agriculture agent and county extension director with the program's Hardy County Extension Office. Welcome back to the show, Jonah.
Thank you, sir.
Cheryl, I'm going to throw this one at you and answer it if you can, or tell me who should answer it. But let's talk about pollinators. That's why we're here today. Define what a pollinator is, as if somebody doesn't know. I know that sounds silly, but, you know, go to first principles here.
All right. So if you look at a flower, there are two processes that that flower needs in order to turn the flower into seeds and be able to reproduce. The first one is pollination, and the second one is fertilization. And in pollination, one flower has to receive a pollen grain from a different flower on its ovary. So there are two reproductive structures within a flower, the male reproductive structure and the female reproductive structure. And the male reproductive structure is made of a long filament that ends in a sac on the top of it. It's called the anther, and it contains the pollen sacs. And the female reproductive structure is an ovary that has a long extension called the style into a landing pad, a sticky place that's called the stigma. That's where the pollen grain has to end up. But most flowers need these pollen grains from a different flower. So it has to make it from the anther of one stamen on a different flower to the stigma on another flower in order to complete the process of pollination. And that requires a pollinator, that insect or animal or anything, the wind even, that can transfer the pollen from one flower to the other.
So if there's a flower, there needs to be a pollinator in almost all cases?
In almost all cases. About 80 to 90% of flowering plants, and we have about 350,000 species of flowering plants, so about 80 to 90% of them require a pollinator. Some can self-pollinate, so they keep their stamen close and they allow their own pollen to pollinate their stigma. But that's very rare because that produces only very low genetic diversity. And some can be taken by the wind, like, for instance, grains, grasses. They have little tassels for these anthers to stick out in little tassels, and the wind will pick it up. And they all kind of come, for lack of a better word, into season. They all become ripe at the same time. Then the wind will pick it up, swirl it around, and then it will distribute it to all the other to the flowers and all the other parts, to the ovaries of those flowers. So the wind kind of takes it and swirls it around.
And that's when, like, we can pull up the pollen count on our phone, effectively, right?
That's right. That's when you begin to sneeze.
Jonah, I think this question's for you. Let's talk about food crops and pollination. You know, do all plants that produce food require a pollinator?
About 75% of them actually require pollination at some point. That does not mean that fruit set entirely depends on a pollinator. It just means that it requires a relationship between the pollinator in the environment and that plant. But, you know, there's a misconception out there that if the bees, the honeybees die, we all die. That's something that we have to really look into context. We do have a lot of native pollinators that are going to probably are going to be better than the honeybee, which is a classic example of a pollinator when you look at it. So things like citrus, peppers, tomatoes, they are things that do not require bees to have, you know, that pollination event, beans, stuff like that. But usually farmers are going to use bees to kind of enhance that fruit set, basically. So you're going to have better yields.
So, Jen, can you give us like a breakdown of what the most common pollinators are?
Absolutely. And Jonah kind of set the stage for me. But there are a lot of pollinators that we have in Southwest Florida that unfortunately we may also view as pests. And beyond the honeybee, beyond the native bees and the wasp, some of our biggest pollinators are butterflies, moths, ants, different things of that nature that we wouldn't think are associated so much with pollination services, but they are prominent in our environment and very involved in pollination.
So does that mean if we go the extra mile to try to keep pests out of our yard, we might be hampering pollination happening?
Yes, you could lead to that assumption, and it all is system-based. We are always looking at balance. So I think a lot of the work that we do with an extension is educating people to who and what we have in our environment and the balance to strike so we don't mess up that ecological balance that we so need in order not only for pollination, but good health for ourselves as well.
What are the best plants to plant in your yard if you want to support pollinators?
Well, it really depends where your yard is, Mike. And we have different terrain here in Florida as well.
So within different regions of our listening area, the answer to that is different.
Yes.
Interesting.
And, and it could even be the difference of what side of 75 you live on.
Huh.
So I would definitely say wherever you are to reach out to us or anyone else who specializes in native flowers and plants for your specific zone to get you started, because that will attract your native pollinators and also help promote pollination services not only in your own yard, but your neighborhood and the region.
Can you give an example of some of the various kinds of plants that are on that list?
So there are a lot of native plants that we've somewhat domesticated, like beautyberry or the native coffee. They produce an abundance of flowers and will attract all kinds of pollinators. Right now, the tea bush is really in bloom and attracting hundreds of bees. If you see one, it has little purple to blue flowers. And there are more inconspicuous things, like one of the things we try to teach homeowners is that not all weeds and grass are bad, because a lot of them will support pollinators, including native ones. So the nectar sources and pollinator flowers sort of attracts the pollinators, the sweetness inside the flower. That can be eaten by many, many different things. And included in the list of pollinators are also things like bats and birds and hummingbirds. And so once that nectar draws in the pollinator, it can be eaten and then shared out, and I've lost my train of thought, but I was going to go to host plants, so.
Well, I can help you out.
And we can talk about the plants that do not need to flower in order to have nectar sources, like the ones that have nectarids. So like passion fruit.
That's where I was
passion
going.
Vine.
Mm-hmm. Dutch pipe vine.
Some of the cucurbits as well, that they have little buttons on somewhere in the plant that are secreting nectar all the time that attracts beneficial pollinators, that attracts wasps that are looking for that prey, and ants, and a lot of cool stuff. And we usually don't look at a plant that is not in bloom as a plant that is having a big effect on our yard, but they, you know, some of them are.
Huh. Jonah, I think most people probably think of honeybees when they think of bees that are found in Florida that do pollination. But, you know, give us a breakdown of the various bees. I know there's lots of bees in Florida. I did a whole show on bees, and that may have been with you, actually, Jonah.
I think so.
Yeah, but, you know, just give listeners a sense of what out there is happening that isn't a honeybee that's been domesticated.
So the poster child for pollination is going to be the European honeybee. It was an introduced species by the conquistadors and everybody that migrated from Europe to the Americas. Before then, we had native bees. There's over 300 species of bees in Florida alone. So we have a lot of biodiversity. All of those species that are native bees are going to be solitary bees, meaning that they're going to be nesting underground on tree cavities, on holes in the wood. Some of them are actually going to eat the wood on our housing, so we don't want them to a certain degree eating on our house. That's why we use treatments for wood. But you can include sweat bees, mason bees, bumblebees, carpenter bees, a lot of these cool looking insects out there in our yard are going to be, you know, making their way and, you know, positively affecting our plants. Another unseen, unsung hero in our yards are going to be moths. We usually associate moths with damage in our yards, but usually moths are going to do the pollination at night, and they're more effective than a lot of the bees that we see flying around.
Cheryl, what are the biggest threats that pollinators face?
Well, I'm gonna pull this out into a little broader picture. In fact, pollinators are just the sentinel for insects at large. About 10 years ago, a prominent entomologist from Costa Rica wrote a biological note in Biological Conservation, and he was just relaying his experience of how much biomass of insects that he has seen decline in. Just, you know, used to drive through the rainforest and would have to put on his windshield wipers just to wipe off all the smudge from the insects. Well, that was decreasing. You couldn't stand under a light at a gas station in Costa Rica because there'd be just clouds of insects. Now they weren't around anymore. So he kind of like raised the alarm. And then researchers picked up on that, and a group from Germany looked over a data set they had for over 3 decades. And this was a data that they had been gathering on insect abundance and diversity in German natural preserves. So this was natural area. And they actually found a decline of about 25 to 30% in just the abundance of the insects. So from a tropical region to a temperate and cold region, the insects were declining. And another group came along and published a metadata analysis of 75 studies across the world. And they related it to different changes in our environment, of course, but they found that the number of insects were just dropping. And if we keep going, we might lose up to 40% of our insect abundance and species in the next couple of decades. So they really highlighted that our abundance is dropping, and they correlated it with urban development, changing natural areas to agricultural areas. Human use is a lot in there, and also a massive amount of pesticide use. So they really correlated with the increase of pesticide research and the increase of pesticide use. The homeowner themselves, the number of gallons used in residential in residential yards of pesticides is in the millions. And we try to keep our immediate area sort of quote-unquote bug-free, but in that, that's spilling over to all of our native populations. And so the biggest threats, of course, is the development and changes of land use and the pesticide use. And now on top of that, we have a warming of the climate. And so we're here in South Florida, we're right on the cusp. We go from a tropical to a subtropical and kind of starting the temperate climate regions. So we feel this change. We can actually see it in the plants. We can see how our more tropical plants are beginning to be established in more northern latitudes. And then we can also see it in the insects, that that's going to have a change in the way that our plants can support our insect populations. And we have to be really start thinking of this as really holistic, because our insect populations make up the basis for a massive food web that feeds birds, lizards, reptiles of all sorts, fish, and that, of course, makes it up into the higher trophic levels. And so if we lose this, if we lose more abundance, just if we just think of it as biomass, it means we can feed less animals up the food chain.
So humans are the biggest threat to pollinators, but humans also require pollinators.
That's right. We are part of the food chain. We do eat the product that pollinators that give us. Even though we have some crops that don't require pollinators for fruit set, we even have developed crops that will not even require the stimulus of being pollinated for fruit set. However, most of, and especially most of our natural foods do require some, or not, except for the grains, but they do require the pollination.
Today, we're revisiting the conversation I had 1 year ago with Cheryl Vanderheiden. She's a residential horticulture extension agent with UF IFAS's Lee County Extension. Jen Hagen, she's a family and consumer sciences agent, also with UF IFAS in Lee County. And Jonah Bosquez, he's an agriculture agent and county extension director with their Hardy County Extension office. The Great Pollinator Census is happening this Friday and Saturday, August 21st and 22nd, across Florida, Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas. If you go to our website, wgcu.org/GCL, you can find links to information about it and how to participate, even if it's just right in your own backyard or neighborhood.
I want to, you know, talk about our current situation with pesticide use. We do have a lot of stricter rules in Florida than what we do in a lot of different parts of the world, including Central America and Costa Rica. I've been around a long time in different countries, and the way that we educate and the way that we require our farmers and landscape workers to use pesticides here, it's a world, a universe of difference between how they use them in other countries. That is important to know. I think habitat modification in the urban setting, where we can just go to the shelf and buy whatever, that's something that needs to be put in front of us here. And the way that we are planning our subdivisions and the way that we're using our land, it's scary. You know, when you look at the environment that we're in, it is extremely diverse, and we are losing that diversity. And the responsible use of pesticide is extremely important. So before you go out and spray your yard, just do some homework. That's what the UF IFAS extension agents are here for, to help you identify that insect that you want to spray. Maybe you don't need to spray it. Maybe you need to modify the environment a little bit so you can make it go away. Or maybe bringing beneficials into your yard in a different manner is going to add a better sustainable solution, instead of just using whatever you can buy at Walmart or any bookstore.
Is what you were saying at the beginning there meaning that we do things better here in the United States than other places around the world, even though we're not doing great here?
We have a lot more rules and a lot more structure and a lot more oversight than in many of the countries outside of the U.S.
And many of the countries outside the U.S. are growing food that we rely on.
That is correct.
Hmm. Yes, Jen.
I think what I was going to mention is just to piggyback on what Jonah was saying about a lot of our pest control here that we educate for with the University of Florida is integrated pest management. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at systems based. You're not looking to treat one thing with one product. You're looking at how all of those things go together and helping make folks aware of, yes, this may be a pest, but take a honeybee, for example. In Florida statute, the bee has two different definitions. One is a pest and the other one is livestock. So then it goes mm-hmm. into considering, okay, while this may be a pest to me because I'm highly allergic, it also supplies honey and it's a animal husbandry that we do for beekeeping. So there's a lot of things that may benefit from certain practices and also result in a negative capacity because of mm-hmm. other practices. So that's the thing that I think is so important when we're looking at pollinators is they're a great way to educate about not only systems, but pests and benefits. And so many of these pollinators, like wasps we're talking about, are so beneficial to have in the garden because they actually go after the pests that we're trying to manage. So by increasing the diversity and the just the presence of all these different insects to work how nature intended can actually be more beneficial to leave it alone than to, you know, mess with it. And so that's one of the things that I love about working with Jonah and working with Cheryl is that we each have a different piece to that and working collectively to educate our clientele or students in the classroom or even folks at the university that may be doing research about how all these things are connected to build capacity to see things in a system and an ecological approach allows a more grounded awareness of our environment and how we can either manipulate or shepherd it.
Yes, Cheryl?
I would like to add that I think we're coming kind of full circle mm-hmm. From a subsistence farming, you know, to going through the green revolution and just exploding our farming capacity. And now we're looking at the system and saying, hey, we need to clean this up before it's all lost. So we're actually coming back to the roots of farming, including how to take care of pests and stimulate pollination. If you look at some of the European systems, they had things like hedgerows way back when. They attracted pollinators to their fields naturally. They had also the beneficial insects that eat those pollinators would be attracted. So there would be more of a consideration of an ecological cycle, like Jen was talking about. And I think we are actually realizing that that is what we need to come back to. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what we're basing some of our programming at IFAS on right now.
The main reason I brought you all together today is to talk about the Great Florida Pollinator Census. So who would like to break down the basics?
All right. So another key to understanding pollinators and to understanding insects in general is to be able to see them, to be able to actually go out and see them sometimes for the very first time and to teach our kids what is out there. So the Great Southeast Pollinator Census was developed by the University of Georgia, and through their extension office, they started to take 2 days of the year in August to use as many people as possible to stand by a pollinator bush for 15 minutes and record what they see. And they've honed this protocol down and have published it. They have a bug guide and a data sheet. If you want to learn about pollinators, if you want to contribute to a count of the abundance of pollinators in the southeastern United States, if you want to be part of this citizen science program that will allow you to be part of the awareness of the conservation of insects and pollinators, as well as teach your children, you can join this program. In Florida, we've joined, I think, about 3 years ago, one of our extension agents from Marion County joined the University of Georgia, and since then it's been growing.
And so anybody can do it. If they just go and download that data sheet and go stand next to a plant and pay attention, they can help contribute.
Yes. They can go to the Great Southeastern Pollinator Census, which is gsepc.org, You can download the count sheet. You can have, there's a video to see how it's done. There's a bug guide for people to familiarize themselves with the groups of bugs, groups of insects. What is great about the census is that you don't have to be an entomologist. You just have to train yourself to distinguish a bee from a fly or a beetle or an ant. And then you, there's a couple of different bees, the carpenter bees from the bumblebees and the small bees. So if you can learn to distinguish those groups, you can join the census. And here in Lee County, we've actually set up six, I call them featured locations, where we will have master gardener volunteers present with the data sheets, with the bug guides, and the brochure, and to teach people what to do if they're unsure about what they should do to join the census.
Well, we will have links to that website and y'all's websites on the web post for this show. This is kind of like the Christmas bird count.
Mm-hmm.
Except
yes,
for pollinators.
Absolutely.
And that's been going on for like 100 and something years. So I guess the goal would be to have that kind of longitudinal understanding through like another 50 years of these counts.
Yeah, we don't have to wait 50 years.
Yeah, let's do it quicker.
Well, you know what I mean. Like, you know, if they keep doing this every year and they have people do it and enough people participate, it really shows some trends.
Absolutely.
Yes, it does. But also right now with the use of GIS and spatial modeling, we can actually already tell what may affect an increase or a decrease in insect numbers, in pollinator numbers, by analyzing the landscape.
Huh. Well, we're pretty much out of time. Do you have any final thoughts you want to leave us with, Cheryl? I'm going to give you each a chance.
I'll say that we brought up some dire things like insect abundance decline, and that's linked to our food systems. But since we have understanding of these things, if we educate ourselves, if we get out there and participate in these kinds of events and we become aware of it, we can turn this around. We just have to get to work.
Jen?
I would just say be engaged. And if the honeybee is what leads you there, invite yourself to learn about and understand the other solitary bees that might take you on another journey.
And Jonah, you get the last word.
Awesome. Yeah, I heard something online that goes like this. You cannot protect what you don't know. Mm. So this is when we train our next generation. That's what I do with my kids. I take them outside. I take them off of the screens, and I give them first world live experiences on how the environment works. Me as a parent of two young boys, I take pride on them knowing more about birds than 99% of the people out there, and knowing the names of trees and knowing how to grab, you know, a bee without getting stung. This is going to develop an appreciation that will follow them for life. Opening avenues for them to understand how their world works. And hopefully in the future, they're going to be scientists and they're going to contribute positively to the environment that we're in. So that's that. As a parent or as a grandparent, invest in getting your kids outside. Getting them involved with this count is probably a good idea. So go ahead and do it.
All right, that is all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guests. Jonah Vasquez is an agriculture agent and county extension director with the UF IFAS Hardy County Extension Office. Thank you, Jonah.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Cheryl Vanderheiden is a residential horticulture extension agent with the UF IFAS's Lee County Office. Cheryl, thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Jen Hagen is a family and consumer sciences agent, also with UF IFAS's Lee County Extension Office. Jen, thank you so much for your perspective.
I have enjoyed being here, Mike. Thank you.
You can find links to more information about the Great Southeast Pollinator Census, including the locations in Lee County that Cheryl mentioned, on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. The official days are this Friday the 21st and Saturday the 22nd, and everyone is invited to participate. Our show today was produced by Emma Rodriguez and myself. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Kinirey. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7, FM. We are NPR for Southwest Florida.